You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear two interviews. The first, a new interview with Jacob Paul. And the second, a discussion with Penguin Books editor-in-chief Patrick Nolan at a time when Penguin is celebrating its 80th anniversary as a publishing house. We'll start with a conversation with Jacob Paul, whose new novel, A Song of Elan, was published this spring by Jaded Ibis Press. Jacob Paul's novel Sarah Sarah was named by Poets and Writers as one of 2010's 5 best debut fictions. His writing has appeared in Hunger Mountain, Western Humanities Review, Green Mountains Review, Massachusetts Review, Seneca Review, Mountain Gazette, The Rumpus, Fiction Writers Review, Numero Cinque Magazine, and USA Today's Weekend Magazine. A former Oppenheimer Fund's product manager and 9/11 World Trade Center survivor, he won the 2008 Utah Writers Contest and the 2007 Richard Scowcroft Prize. He has an MFA in writing from Vermont College and a PhD from the University of Utah. Jacob Paul teaches creative writing at High Point University in North Carolina. The author Douglas Glover says, "Jacob Paul's A Song of Elan is a tour de force of structural experiment that leaves not a thread untied and moves from beginning to end with a mesmerizing, if not say, horrifying, fatality. Elan, once an Israeli soldier, shot a suicide bomber to death in a cafe. 10 years later, alcoholic, spiritually paralyzed, he turns himself into a suicide bomber, haunting the New York subway system with explosives under his coat, the only truth he knows, the only way to God. A spectacular book, beautiful in its rhymes, daunting in its ethical interrogation." When I spoke with Jacob Paul last week, I asked him to begin by reading from A Song of Elan.
Standing on a small stone, Elan flattens his palm against a cliff rising above the carriage road. Horizontal striations create roofs and ledges. From the smaller ledges, gnarled bonsai cypresses sprout. Full trees rise out of the largest. Behind him, sitting on a low stone wall that separates the carriage road from a steep wooded hillside stretching down to the Hudson River's plains, his wife rifles through her pack, a rustling that harmonizes with that of fallen leaves caught in the wind. "Once there was a before," he thinks, "a before in which this cliff was made of gray rock that, hewn to blocks, could build the wailing wall. Once there was a before, and the words are abstract." He tilts his head as if to imagine the 80-foot climb above. The words are sad in the abstract. The concrete events, a shooting in Tel Aviv, an escape to New York City, leaving the derech, the path of righteousness, are, well, concrete. Wailing wall, he thinks, as at that famous relic, tufts of vegetation fracture the cliff's conglomerate rock. "I have a nostalgia for a period in which I had a nostalgia," he mouths. The pain he feels is not for the passion with which he once prayed at the last standing wall of the old temple in Jerusalem, but for the young man walking whole Manhattan neighborhoods in a summer evening, awkward in his new secularism. It's for his wonder at junk stores on Mulberry, spiked with memories of the old city's shook, as if lower Manhattan streets were equal exchange for stone alleyways 2 millennium old, a few stores selling knockoff watches and cheap baseball hats, as colorful as the place where bins of fish heads divided crates of fresh eggs from street cobblers. He looks over at the blue-helmeted woman who's begun scaling horsemen. She moves quickly, placing her hands and feet precisely in seams and on small protrusions. He tilts his head back further still to follow her ever higher ascent, and suddenly he loses his balance, steps backwards to stay standing. He wonders if he isn't maybe too sick? Too sick to climb? No. Too something. What something? Scared? Too something. Too drawn to the 23-year-old wandering the windswept concrete fissures of lower Manhattan, chilly in his first real suit, desperate for the warmth of a bar, of a strange woman's smile, too whatever, scared, yes, but off balance, really, too off balance to climb the hard, short thing next to horsemen his wife mentioned over their omelet's darkening remains. Blue Helmet told him its name, apoplexy, but knowing what to call the collection of minute ledges and tiny cracks that constitute a route up this section of the cliff doesn't make him feel much better about leaving the ground. He craves a cold or the flu, an emergency call from work or a car accident in the S-curves below, a sudden intervention and detention by Homeland Security. But hell with it. Today is another day that Yadid has chosen to spend with him. If he can string enough of these together, if they can stay together through enough of these days, there will again be a time in which your deed is not, he doesn't dare say it. There will be a time in which Ilan will feel comfortable, even when he isn't wearing the black vest. There will be a time in which his wife's performance voice in city bookstores doesn't evoke a bullet wound in a young woman's chest, just inches above unexploded coils of nails and bolts and dynamite and exovisera, a missed immolation. There will be a time, sure there will, but that time seems even more abstract than the words that sadden him. That time is like the cab ride home you've promised to yourself, for right after you finish the drink you just ordered.
Thank you very much. Thanks for reading
that.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how A Song of Ilan began for you and where you started this book.
I started this book so long ago, and it began, I suppose, in ease, arrogance, and hubris, and quickly moved to pain and suffering. the summer after I'd finished what would be pretty much the final draft of Sarah Sarah, which I wrote really quickly and immediately found an agent for, therefore feeling like, you know, any day Oprah would come and find me. I was sort of like, I need a writing project. And so I was like, I'm going to write a short story. And I was intrigued by this notion of a character who would be so afraid of a suicide bombing that he would plan one to make sure that he would get caught, to reassure himself that Homeland Security would catch someone.
Okay.
And I took that short story into my very first workshop in PhD. And I was the first person to go in workshop because I had it written. And again, you know, arrogance, hubris. Francois Kemwan, who, you know, was running the workshop. And he's like, looks at the story and he's like, it's a novel, which I think is just his, like, parlor trick for making students sad for the rest of their lives. So I was like, okay, I could probably do that. And, you know, I think there's exactly one image left from that original story, and that's of the vice president of his company comforting him after he vomits in the bathroom. But what did evolve pretty quickly for me was a realization that in Sarah Sarah there had been this moment where she has a panic attack in the future tense about a bus that she's on blowing up, and she keeps thinking different people are going to be the bomber. She keeps looking for who is going to blow up this bus she's on in Jerusalem. And eventually, in her retelling of this to her imagined, I suppose, lover in the future tense, she imagines the bomber as herself. And I think as I look back at that, I recognize that the question I had thematically after writing Sarah Sarah was less about how one responds to the spiritual crisis that might be invoked by a religious suicide bombing or any suicide bombing, and more one about how one would come to think a religious act might constitute blowing oneself up along with a lot of other people. And as that question evolved, it sort of evolved into a recognition that if indeed an attack like 9/11 is an act of worship, and much as it's a political act, I do think of that as an act of worship by those terrorists. They're not brainwashed kids. They're not immediately in the midst of political throes. They're old enough to understand their own religious crises, but they're doing it out of religion. I mean, the story about Muhammad Atta visiting a strip club in Las Vegas 3 nights before getting on the plane, or 2 nights, whatever it is, and then leaving a note in his car in Logan Airport's parking lot saying, you know, no women should touch his remains, such as they might remain. That to me is a person who's in a deep space of religious crisis. And I began to think, well, maybe then if this act being performed for God is an act of worship, it's somehow some kind of answer to a particular kind of crisis or question.
Mm-hmm.
And of course I had, you know, really no interest in examining that question through Islam or Christianity for that matter. Those aren't faiths I know well, but I didn't imagine the religious question as being born inside of a faith, but faith being a way of the question being manifested and answered. So that led me to this character, Ilan, who comes to build a bomb that he desperately doesn't want to have blow up. He doesn't want to blow up. He doesn't even quite know why he's building the bomb, but he has this religious crisis, and this seems to be a kind of answer. And so that's kind of what I've worked with. To write that was really hard, in part because figuring out the structure through which it might evolve was really challenging. I started off with something that was closer to a condition than to a conflict, in the sense that initially I was like, I've got this guy wearing a bomb under his vest who's hitting on a girl in a subway train. But that sounds conflict-laden, but it's not actually, there's not desire and conflict, which is what I think of now as the conflict that drives narrative. There's just a really charged condition, but that's setting. So the book, it ended up being my dissertation for PhD. So it took up all of my PhD, 4 years from that workshop on. During my dissertation defense, my committee got into a scrabble about the ending. And Francois was like fighting with two other professors. Two of the professors thought the ending was super justified. One professor was like, I just like this character. And, you know, and the other two, I think, were like, we like him. Blah. You know, and then one of my good friends who was at the defense, who is a PhD candidate in my cohort, tried to interject a solution, and Francois, who's one of the sweetest men I know, like yelled at her, that's stupid, shut up. Like, oh my god, get me out of here. Like, especially because it's a fight in a context in which you already know that you're guaranteed to pass. Like, they don't bring you up for a creative defense unless they're, you know, it's supposed to be more like a ceremony, not an ordeal, but one last
I don't know, I think
endure.
this book deserved the ordeal.
But then it required, I think, you know, another couple of years of work after that. I probably worked on it actively and primarily until 2009, so that's 5 years. And then Sarasar was coming out, so I put it down and worked on another text for a long time, and then it got picked up by Jaded Ibis.
Right.
And then I really thought it was done when it went to Jaded Ibis, you know, minus the normal typo finding, which I continue to find to my dismay. And I sent it out to this guy, Robert Alter, because the Psalms are a really important part of the book, these translations of the Psalms, and that's part of what drives Ilan's anxiety, is that the way these Psalms are translated points at the ways in the Hebrew that the speaker is so often sarcastic or bitter, bitter at having to ask God to essentially be God, like, remember your servant, you know,
right.
Rescue your servant who has always been faithful. Like, God needs this extra reminder to do what God is supposed to do, or sarcastic even, where like they're like, you who are so great, like, get me out of this.
Right. I wanted to just mention that you went to a boarding school in high school that you referred to in your bio as a black hat yeshiva, and the curriculum was almost entirely built around Talmud study. So, and I figured that had to affect your knowledge of this subject matter. And so I wanted to actually ask you about that, and then we can move more into the religious aspect of the book.
Sure.
Where was that school?
The school was in Rochester, New York.
Oh.
Which was sort of fun because I went to college in Buffalo and I went to SUNY Buffalo, which is a secular school. So I had a lot of friends who were from Rochester, and I tell them I went to a boarding school in Rochester, and they're like, where? And I would say on Park Avenue, and they were like, what? And then I was like, you know that big brick building that used to be a hospital and kind of looks like one, where you only see a couple of people wearing, like, you know, like black Stetsons and jackets going in and out? And then they'd be like, oh, maybe. <You know? laughs> Yeah, so I went there for the last 2 years of high school. My family had always been fairly religious. We became probably fully Orthodox around when I was seven. And that's a little of a journey, too. So, like, the commitment to Orthodoxy was probably made when I was seven, and the full arrival probably by the time I was... we moved to Israel for a year when I was 10 as part of that process, in an attempt to emigrate there, a failed attempt for as much economic reasons and just the practicalities of being an immigrant, which are hard anywhere.
You're saying your whole family became Orthodox?
My whole family became Orthodox.
Okay, I wasn't sure if you were saying it was a personal decision that you made through this period of time. Okay, go ahead.
No, but it was a decision that, like, I think all of us were deeply on board with, whether through indoctrination or, you know, family indoctrination, not any people with pocket watches dangling on chains.
Right.
and, And so we all became Orthodox, and, you know, we went to synagogue all the time and did all of that, and I had a Hebrew tutor and went to Hebrew classes, and there were a couple of dabblings with religious schools. I was sent away, of all places, to a military school for my sophomore year of high school, because things were rough both with my academics and with my family. And I came back home in part because it was too hard to be Orthodox there. And my folks, we were living in D.C. for the year, sent me to a Orthodox day school there. But then the family stuff was whacked, so they sent me to this Black Hat yeshiva, which had a seminary appended to it. So really, you went to high school, but by your senior year, you were in the seminary, and then you would stay in the seminary indefinitely, I suppose.
Wow.
Until you got married, at which point you transfer to the kollel, which is part of the seminary, and you'd stay there until you're in your mid-30s. And then maybe you would move, I don't know. So that was the orientation of the school. And we did learn, you know, Talmud most of the time, which is in Aramaic. We did learn Biblical Hebrew too, some, but less emphasis on that, surprisingly. In the years that followed, I spent a lot of time working on both my modern and Biblical Hebrew versus a classics major in undergraduate, and then just ad hoc style, and then again in PhD as my language requirement. And I became really interested in the ways in which a biblical interpretation works with its commentators, in that there's so much pressure put on the language because every word is supposedly sacred and intentional.
Right.
So what we ordinarily do with a piece of fiction or a poem is done a hundredfold for many, many generations. And Hebrew poetry, which the Psalms definitely fall inside of, because of the structure of that language, which uses these three-letter roots called shorishes for everything, is able to make puns and allusions in a way that English isn't very good at. So there is this constant opportunity for reinterpretation and misinterpretation and different interpretation. And there's also a lot of allusion that happens as a consequence, too, to other sections of the Bible. And I think in graduate school, I was actually quite interested in trying to do a translation of the Psalms. When I realized that was an impossibly hard task, I said I would just have a character who had done it.
Yeah. So you mean when you were getting your PhD or when you were in the MFA?
When I was getting my PhD, yeah.
Okay. So and a lot of your work so far has had to do with Judaism and biblical study and these themes. Do you think that that's going to sort of be where you always kind of lean?
You know, I just this past summer, I want to say, had a conversation with the chaplain at my university, which is loosely affiliated with the most left end of the Methodist Church, and he's a good buddy. And we were talking, and he's like, "Wouldn't you consider yourself a religious writer?" And, you know, I'm very resistant to that label, and finally I was like, fine. but that said, you know, my third novel, which is pretty close to done, is a continuation of the thematic trilogy that begins with Sarasara, and that really, I had to do a lot of revision to Song of Elan this fall, unexpectedly, I guess, well, last summer and into the fall, and part of the capacity to do that revision, I think, was because this third book was sort of done, and I suddenly understood that this was a thematic trilogy that was asking one question across three different kinds of opportunities, and that the inquiry was sequential, so I could kind of focus this more on to where I wanted it to go.
Right.
And since then, my projects I've been working on for the last year and a half, 2 years or so, the third novel having kind of been not shelved, but made dormant while launching this second novel, because there's not much to do with a novel while you're launching a novel, if the novel's pretty close to done. They have not been religious in their orientation. I've been really interested in seeing what it's like to work collaboratively with other people in strange spaces.
Yeah.
And then I've been doing a lot of nonfiction that sort of dabbles in a space between theory, personal essay, and something else. And that work is, I think, is leading gradually towards what I would call an ethical memoir, or a memoir of the ethic of my personal ethics of representation, having written and continuing to write about religion and terrorism and that kind of thing. But I don't think it's specifically religious in the way that these three books are.
Okay. let's talk some more about the novel, A Song of Ilan. It's full of subjects, you know, that we could talk about for a long time. Terrorism, mm-hmm. self-defense, defense of country, religion, prayer, sex, rock climbing. There's a lot happening in this book. So I wanted to know, let's talk a little bit about the military portion of it, that he has been an Israeli soldier. So have you ever served in the military anywhere?
No, my closest scrape was going to military school my sophomore year of high school, which is not the same as serving in the military at all.
Yeah. So do you know people that have been in the Israeli military? Did you research that section of the book pretty intensely?
I do know a lot of people who've been in the Israeli military. I don't think I had to research that particular section in any great depth, because the basic stuff that plays into this particular text is so prevalent and readily accessible, and part of, I think, of Jewish culture in America as much as it is Jewish culture in Israel. I mean, everyone sort of knows, like, you have to do your 3 years of mandatory service in the IDF after you get out of high school, and then you're in the reserves until you're, I don't know, 60 or something, and you do 40 days a year or something like that, and you know, when you're in service, you carry your gun with you all the time, even when you're not on duty, not because you have to, but just because it's like convenient and practical.
Right.
Because of the nature of the way their military works and the compactness of the country, I think, you know, people are based out of their homes as much as out of a barrack. So having your gun with you is really normal. Being in the military is really normal. Ilan goes back because it's a requirement of his citizenship, which he's maintained even though he wasn't raised in Israel.
Right.
Shooting a terrorist is, you know, that doesn't, I didn't have to do too much research on what that would look like. I did do some research on what the explosives would be like and the mechanisms for the explosion, mm-hmm. which was, you know, terrifying online. So I was like, maybe Homeland Security really will find me.
Right, yeah.
But nobody mentioned that I'm on a watch list consequently.
Have you been stopped at airports lately?
Not more than usual. one thing that was interesting, though, in that regard is that the way Jaded Ibis releases its books, they have, in addition to the black and white edition, which is like a standard book, a color edition which has art by an artist who's responding to the text, not illustrating it. It's like full color. And then potentially a soundtrack. And I have this friend, Shlomi Levy, who is launching an act called Van Goose. He was in a very famous for Israel and apparently Russia rock band called Biluim for a long time, and then he was in Marcy Playground, and still is, I suppose. So he agreed that this was an interesting project to him, and so he made a soundtrack that goes with it, and we did some performances together, which were super weird and really fun and anxiety-inducing for me, because I was like, I don't know how to do this kind of thing.
Were you reading along to the music, or what was your part of the performance?
So what we did is we decided, like, we didn't want to do any, as Stormy put it, none of that spoken word BS, you know, like, so what would happen is, like, his music is largely instrumental with, like, some screaming and chanting and like, drone singing. And we each played, I want to say, we each had 7 sections of performance. And so one of us would start, depending upon the gig. We had these little, those bells you put on the desk at a hotel to call for service. We push mm-hmm. a button and things. We each had one of those. So when one of us was finishing our section, we would hit our bell, and then the other person would know it was their section. And our ambition always was, like, in this exchange, to also interrupt each other, but clearly as in a supporting role. And by our final performance in New York, I think we'd like to do more performances, but the last we've done so far at this not-for-profit art space called The Hive, which is, like, chock full of Israelis. You know, like, we were at the point where we had added a drummer who had a full drum kit in addition to Shlomi's little bit of drums and his synths. And, you know, we wore, like, these suits. I had this 3-piece peach leisure suit that was, like, almost white. And Shlomi, in that show, because his suit was dirty from travel, was wearing, like, a trench coat and a tie. And then we had a full light show. And, you know, like, he would play music and at times during my readings and sort of interrupt me and try to throw me off my game, which was, you know, part of our trick to make it tense. And there were sections where I was chanting psalms loudly while he was trying to read, or reading some of the polemic sections at the top of my voice, and he would scream back at me in Arabic. So we're doing it that way. But there were one Israeli audience attendee who's married to my friend Angel, got up a number of times during the performance and left. And I thought either A, he was bored, B, he wanted to talk on his cell phone, or C, I'd offended him. Angel afterwards was like, no, he was a conscientious objector during the First Intifada, and while he was serving, he refused to serve in occupied territories, and so he spent most of his military service in jail, and he was just triggered a lot, so he just kept leaving when he couldn't handle it anymore.
Wow.
And came back when he felt he could.
Wow.
And in my first reading in Salt Lake, there was a little bit of radio promotion, which was great, and a guy came and came up to me afterwards, and he'd asked a bunch of questions during the reading, or at the end of the reading, and he said, you know, I'm your guy, like I was an American who went and served in the military in Israel, and I heard about the book and I really wanted to come and hear it, and now I'm excited to read it. And I think it was people like him that I was terrified of, because I'm presenting this character who can't contend with the basic work of being in the military,
right?
Which is to shoot people who might kill you.
Yeah.
And
kill others.
And kill others, right. And I was glad that he still wanted to buy the book after hearing me read from it. So that was a relief.
Well, actually, that's a good lead-in. Why don't we have you read that other section that you were gonna read?
Sure.
And then we'll keep talking a little more after that.
Okay, so for this section, Ilan has gotten onto the climb, and while he's climbing, he's having essentially either we could call it a spiritual crisis-based flashback or a PTSD flashback, where the rock has become the body of this Palestinian woman who he shot, you know, a decade some prior.
Yeah.
And he's at a moment where he's really panicked and he doesn't have very good protection of the rock, which means that if he falls, he might really hurt himself. And his friends and wife, who's belaying him below, are yelling up at him to climb, and he's just kind of gripped and stuck on the rock. He's at some point in his attempt to reconcile his crisis, he's found a video of an Iranian porn star, and he feels like she's as close to what he imagines the Palestinian woman might be if he were to sleep with her. And this is, well, it is what it is.
Okay.
Start reading. Sweat pours down his face and chest. If he falls, he won't die up there. He'll die on the ground right where they're standing. Sweat accumulates between his finger and the rock. His own body lubricates his demise. His legs tremble. He'll fall. He is so obviously going to fall, so obviously wants to fall, and he can never love anyone after Yadid again anyway. I could have stayed drunk, he whispers to the rock. Hope is worse than hopelessness. I could have died feeling the way I feel. Why didn't you let me, Yadid? Why trick me into this attempted happiness? If he doesn't move, he will fall, and if he falls, he will probably die. I don't want to be alone up here with a dead Palestinian woman, he whispers to the rock. And the rock plays back the Iranian porn star's thick genitalia. Climb, Ilan. Climb. Please, 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 Habibi. His arms ache. The coat's hem is thickening with blood, threatening his grip. The rock radiates cold that chills his sweat-soaked organs. His legs tremble. Sewing machine legs. Elvis legs. He tries to lower his heels to take some pressure off his calves, but the falling tricams keep dropping and dropping and dropping. He looks down. Yadid faces away from him. She's preparing to run backwards to take in slack. If he falls, she'll run in a desperate attempt to keep him off the ground, always running to keep him from crashing. Finally, he understands why that second line of the Shema is meant to be whispered, out of mercy. The martyr is dying. He spent his last breath shouting, Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. He has no strength left. At best, if he lives that long, he can confess the second line to himself. Why make him feel that there was something more he could do? Better to require that he whisper it to himself, make mandatory the inevitable, that private reassurance at the very end. Come on, buddy, Lewis yells up. It's easy moves from where you are. Get to the roof. Baruch Shem Kavod Machuto Leolam Voed. Blessed is the name of his courageous kingdom forever and always. Ilan, you have to move. He lifts his left foot, places it on an edge, and pushes. He forces air in and out of his lungs, and then he moves his right hand, grips a rounded gray knob over his head, and feels it dig into his fingertips. It bends beneath his pressure. He thinks, I'm holding on to the cartilage in her nose. It can't possibly hold his whole body weight. He turns his head down and scrunches his face against the image of his hand pulling her cheeks from her eye sockets, against the image of his mother pulling chicken apart, and wills his elbows to straighten, his shoulder to relax, his body to hang from the hold. He seizes on an image of his house, a square stone farmhouse with a four-sided peaked wooden roof. It sits on a rise in the close-hemmed deciduous woods. This morning, they woke to strong sunlight through the east-facing bedroom windows. After pattering down the worn wood stairs, Ilan observed frost in the crevices of the Adirondack chairs on the flagstone patio beyond the sunroom's glassed-in walls. The house is built out of fleece blankets, fabric softener, and fresh-scented dishwasher detergent. Ilan wants to curl on the living room couch with a latte and a magazine. What have you done to deserve such comfort, he wonders. If he falls, Yedit will run backwards, but that won't save him. He must climb higher, further away from her diminishing form. And in the disconnected glow of under-cabinet kitchen lighting, Yedit shuttles away from him, or he shuttles away from her. Ilan can't tell which, but that the house image gradually collapses, his arms tremble, the Palestinian woman's nose twitches in his grasp, moving upwards only increases the distance of the fall. Damn you, he corrects himself. The length of the fall no longer matters. It's all too far. Another hand up, another move. If the space between not falling and safety is the length of the woman's body, then he's parallel with her breasts. Yedit now pays attention to him exclusively. He can see in his periphery the cocoon from within which she isolates Louis, who continues to hang on her borders, whispering words she does not hear. Louis whispers that he and Ilan have climbed far worse. He whispers that Ilan once froze in the middle of an ice rock in the Catskills after his feet blew out. Ilan hung there by his axes, his arms slowly giving up, dangling like a leaf melting out of an icicle. But then, as if by magic, Ilan kicked one crampon-tipped foot into the ice, and then the other slowly began to climb again. Louis whispers that a god haunts Ilan, a deity who will neither disappear into ether nor offer salvation. Ilan wishes he could cast Louis's voice out of his head, Louis putting math to God, making God into arithmetic, an algorithmic truth, a half-understood minute dimension, a body of constants for equations of the unknowable.
That's great. Thank you so much for reading that.
Sure.
You know, I had a question, and the Shema is such a huge part of what's going on for Ilan. I thought I could we could talk a little bit about that. I wondered if you could talk about conveying the power of the Shema to a non-Jewish reader, or conveying the power of another culture or religion to an audience of readers that might not share that culture or religion.
It's really hard, I think, to convey those kinds of things, and I'm not sure that that I do. I don't know if I do.
Well, do you think your audience is mostly going to be the Jewish reader?
You know, I don't think so.
No.
I think it's probably half, but I don't think in any way exclusively. In my experience with Sarah Surratt, it seemed that the people who were interested in my work were people who had some kind of relationship, whether ongoing or lapsed, with some sort of faith that had been fundamentalist in some kind of way. Because I think that the crises I'm interested in often speaks to that audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that's perhaps a feature of how fundamentalism works, or at least it does in the West, is that there's always a body of text that one is trying to read for signs of an absolute answer. And in Judaism and in Islam, I think that that body of text is literally the text. And I think that in the versions of Christianity that are less text-based, probably it's something about the world or about feelings. And I think those things get muddled inside of Western versions of Judaism and Islam. So I think the Shema is, any Jewish reader will, I think, know that this is like the fundamental prayer.
Right.
It's the one where you say, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one," and you're
mm-hmm.
supposed to shout that. And it's interesting in that it's a prayer that predates the fall of the temple. Most of the prayers that Jews say each day are replacements for blood sacrifice. And That one is not. That's something you're supposed to declare, and all the martyrs, when they're being tortured to death by Romans and all of our lore, like, they scream out that line. And then, you know, there's this line you say very quietly, then there's three more paragraphs of text. I think that one of the challenges I've had with this book throughout, especially probably in the third section where Ilan is actually wearing a bomb, is to show how this text would authorize this body of action, how that would go cycle through his crisis into it. Mm-hmm. And that's really, even the last round of revisions, that was the challenge, how to make the translations and the text, the religious text, do that lyric leap. And I think studying poetry is probably the place where to have that in my work. And I think it's about kind of not just a repetition of the lines to give them more and more weight and to give them, let them accrue different kinds of meaning as they pick up across the context of the book, which is the way I think religious text works in the world too, over generations, but then to have the incremental interpretation and translation pick up that weight as well.
Yeah.
I had an Israeli friend, actually the chief of staff for Mark Levine's, who's the New York City council member, who's the chair of the New York City Jewish caucus.
Right.
New York City Council's Jewish caucus, I should say. She had read the book before, you know, talking to him and getting him to blurb it. And she got to the end and she's sort of like, oh, like, you've made the Shema into, like, the, you know, the cry that we associate with Muslim terrorists when they're saying God is great or something. And I was like, yeah. And she's like, but it was always that, wasn't it? And I was like, yes, I think it's always been that. It's just we don't think of it that way. And so I think it's that repetition that lets you see the thing newly.
Yeah.
That's the device. And I don't. And again, like, I'm not. I hope it works. I don't know that it works.
Oh, I totally think it works. And another aspect of the narrative that I thought worked really, really well was the fact that his wife is an atheist translator of religious text, and that was just such a fantastic complication. Just generally, apart from the amount of angst that it gives him, the amount of difficulty that it gives him to try to figure out where his allegiances are, you know, and what he believes, and also you also have her voice kind of woven in, talking about what certain things mean and how best things would be translated, and I don't know, that was very interesting to me as well.
Thanks.
Let's see. Well, you know, okay, so this is kind of a minor thing, but the book is less than 200 pages long, and you know, it's such a complex piece of fiction. It covers so much actual ground and also emotional ground, and I found this very impressive. Do you write long and revise short, or do you write short, or how does that work for you?
I think my usual view of this book's length is that I worked on a book for 5 years nonstop with a lot of time dedicated to working on it because I was a PhD student or on fellowship, and then for another, you know, probably 6 months at 30 hours a week, and all I have to show for it is 185 pages. it seems like a really terrible rate of production. I think with this book, it was so hard to figure out how to write it and how to get past the themes, and even just to figure out what it was I was writing, that, you know, for the first couple of years, I would write until I had a frustration or realization, and then I would scrap all of it and start over, and then keep working that way. So it's probably actually the longest it's ever been.
Yeah.
The last round of revision added about 8,000 words, to put it in context, which is, and I think that's something like 7% of the book or so.
Yeah.
And that was because I got in touch with Robert Alter, who's kind of the preeminent current translator of Biblical Hebrew into English, and who actually his book of Psalms that he translated after I'd defended my dissertation already, so I can't say, no one can blame me for having taken his idea or something, you know, it was released by Norton as like a thing you can buy at any Barnes and Nobles, and so I felt like the least believable part of my book, which was that Yadid might actually have a best-selling translation of the Psalms, was the one thing that actually has now happened in the world in some way. But he read the first section and was like, yeah, I'll blurb this, and then he read the whole thing and was like, I can't blurb this. But then he wrote me this really long, detailed body of notes on where he also thought my translations had run afoul of what they should be, which was extremely kind. He's a, you know, he's a endowed chair at Berkeley, and this is his gig, so he basically gave me peer review notes. And I don't think those notes were why he wasn't willing to blurb it. I redid all the translations with a couple of lexicologies in front of me, and they had to change. And but that changing actually then generated other ways of accessing the text, and I hope that in that process I may have addressed what I imagine his concerns were.
Yeah. I want to ask you, so there's quite a lot of sex or sexual reference in the book, and I wonder if we can talk about that. You know, I thought the description and detail of sex in this book is absolutely perfect for who this character is. It's pretty graphic, and I wondered if you could talk about the best way to approach writing sex in you know, in a literary novel. You know, so often it's just like a lead-in scene followed by a breakaway, and then there's a new scene where they may or may not be smoking, right? or it's just like super schlocky. I don't know. And the sex in this book is it's literary, but it's also very graphic. So why, I don't know, does that ring any bells? Do you have thoughts?
Sure. I think I got asked to read at Davidson College or to speak to a creative writing class at Davidson College right as the book was coming out. And they had read the book, like they got like the first prints of it or something. We rushed to them. And so when some kids, first they asked me to read a section in which the character says the C word, which was, you know, maybe my least comfortable moment in front of students, but I felt like if I bailed on saying the word, I would be, you know, undermining their professor who had taught the book. So I had to run with it. And eventually I came down to it. I was like, this isn't the book with which I would represent how I would want people who I might want to have a sexual relationship to think about me or about sex. And as I've gone and given other readings, and people come and comment on the sex, like I keep being like, it's really kind of icky, and they're like, yeah. So I think the character's having a crisis of faith that's based on the absence of a God who's willing to resolve things and be visibly present, and he's having a crisis of a relationship where his wife is becoming unknowable. So there's two kinds of romantic absences happening at once. And I think one of the ways in which people try to solve romantic absence is through physical contact with people, right? Like with sex.
Yeah.
And, but if that sex is, if that becomes empty and doesn't fulfill the desire the character has, like that sex is then going to be at once an obsession and at once icky even to them. So it'll be ickier in its recollection, perhaps, even than it is in its practice. Which I think, to then going back to like, well, writing about sex, what is that all about? I think that sex needs to be an action inside of the text the same way as hitting or a hug would be. Like it has to do some kind of work to further the conflict. It's either on the side of the character in that it's helping the character achieve their aims, or it's on the side of the loosely defined antagonist in that it's working against the character's aims in some kind of way. And here that sex is constantly an action taken by the character in an attempt to forward some sort of peace or desire, and it's constantly becomes then an obstacle and an impediment that's working against him in many different kinds of ways. And I think that was really the avenue into writing it, was just to keep having it be this thing that's doing stuff to him that he can't help be with. And it's awkward to write graphic sex scenes, and it's especially awkward to write graphic sex scenes that are kind of icky.
What do you mean by icky when you say icky? You mean
his sexual politics and position are... he talks about having sex regularly with people who he finds disgusting afterwards for really specific physical things. He compares anatomy to lunch meat in its way it's being pulled apart. He wants to get it on with Yadid even as he wants to break up with her, and he does so like out of some really complex spaces. Like the sex he engages in is not like necessarily icky in the sense of, you know, someone got tied up and someone got peed on. It's it's icky in the sense that, though, that it's, I think, continuously demeaning for himself and for the people he has it with, whether or not they're aware that that's demeaning. He thinks of it as demeaning for both of them, and he's tied to this notion in the same way as, like, his spiritual relationship is demeaning to him in some way, and his sense of himself as a agented person in the world doesn't quite work. He keeps hoping for this kind of radically pure intimate contact that he can't quite access or get to.
Okay, all right.
I feel much more awkward talking about this X-Men.
Well, it's so funny because, in fact, writing is a very solitary pursuit, but then when you have to get up in front of people and read what you've written, you have to feel comfortable with that, or you have to make your way through it or talk about it. Well, I thought it was really well done, if that helps. I thought it was very, very much in line with who this character is, and it helped me understand him and helped me feel like I understood what was hard for him and what was going on in his head, which is it's a hard thing to understand because you present his narrative through a lot of burden and a lot of obsession and a lot of maybe illness, we could say. I don't know. Like the way that he's thinking is, it's not easy necessarily to always follow, but I thought it also came across a lot like the way we think, which isn't just all like outlined. And I thought that the sex helped understand who he helped us understand who he was. Okay. I just have one last question for you, Jacob.
Sure.
So a lot of the listeners are writers, and I usually end up by asking people for a little bit of advice about something. My question for you is if you have any advice for writing about a foreign subject or setting.
Sure. I think that the subject versus setting question are a little, maybe they're not that different. My finding has been that writing about something that's a little bit foreign is really useful because we end up accessing it through the space of the imagination as opposed to through the space of documentation. Mm-hmm. And if you access something through the space of imagination, you're able to write it the way people would want to encounter it. I mean, writing is ultimately a completely figurative act, and reading is a act of refiguration out of that figurative act. So, for example, when I was working on Sarah Sarah, I was writing about the Arctic, which I've not been to, and about ocean kayaking, which I've done like four times, but I'm not an ocean kayaker. And what that meant is I did all this research into the Arctic, and I got in touch with some people when stuff didn't resolve between different narratives, and I thought about the Arctic all the time, and I did all this research into how one ocean kayaks and the dangers, and I read like this Deep Seas, Deep Troubles book, which was all about kayaking accidents, and then I could just kind of write it. When I started writing this book, rock climbing was at least half my life, with the other half being probably PhD.
And I wondered about that. So you do the rock climb, the kind of rock climbing that Elon does.
I've been on every one of those climbs he mentions.
Okay.
But I don't anymore. I have a set of shoulder injuries. I've got a lot of excuses. I can't do anything. But the initial challenge was that I found myself writing this technical document trying to be faithful to what the climb would involve. And that's not actually very interesting.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and then he moved his left foot into a sideways camming hold, used a, you know, number 7 Camelot placed on a horizontal axis, clipped into
it, like
no one cares. Like that's like a white paper. But it's hard to break away from that because that's the way you would think about the climb if you're a climber.
Right.
And I think like maybe 2 or 3 years into the writing process, in that attempt to get out of that, the flashbacks became the rock, and so the internal figurative stuff became the external figurative stuff, and that was the breakthrough for me. I think the reason I wanted to divide between subject and setting initially is that I think of all good writing as necessarily being about subjects to which we don't have answers, because I think about writing as being an attempt to figure something out that we don't already know the answer to. So it, for me, like the question that Elon has about this particular religious crisis in these acts, it's the question is deeply, deeply personal, and constantly present and real to me. But the resolution of it, the action that resolves and thinks it through, that's my attempt to think through the question. That's, of course, new and foreign and not my own in that sense.
That's great. That's wonderful. The book is A Song of Ilan, a novel by Jacob Paul, published by Jaded Ibis Press. So, Jacob, thank you so much. I really love talking to you today and catching up and talking about this wonderful book.
Thank you so much, Sheila, for having me on your show and for talking to me about the book. It was really fun.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Jacob Paul. You can learn more about his work at his website, jacobgpaul.com. And you can also access my 2010 interview with Jacob about his debut novel, Sarah Sarah, on the Write the Book website. That interview is notable not only for Jacob's wit and insight, but for how witheringly hot the studio was when he joined me in person for one of the only live interviews I've ever conducted on the show. We had about 4 fans blowing on us. I think we had a couple of emergency vehicles go by during the conversation. It's amazing that either of us could be heard at all. There is a reason the station was initially nicknamed the Radiator. That first building was very, very, very warm. And Jacob was a trooper. Anyway, listen to that one. That's a fun conversation, too. My second interview this week is with Patrick Nolan, Vice President, Editor-in-Chief, and Associate Publisher of Penguin Books, which is celebrating its 80th anniversary. In 1935, Alan Lane had a revolutionary idea to offer affordable quality paperback books through outlets like railway stations and newsagents, as well as bookshops. Lane launched his new line of books on July 30th, 1935, with 10 inexpensive paperbacks. Within a year, Penguin had sold 3 million copies. An innovative publishing model had been launched into the world. Little did Lane realize the impact his paperback revolution would have on reading. 80 years later, Penguin Books remains one of the leading publishers of high-quality paperbacks and ebooks that represent some of the best of literary fiction, nonfiction, mysteries, debuts, and gift books. Patrick Nolan joined Penguin as an associate publisher and editor-in-chief in 2012 after serving for 12 years as trade paperback sales director for Penguin Group. He now oversees the editorial direction and shape of Penguin Books' publishing program. In his previous role as sales director, he contributed to such long-running bestsellers as Eat, Pray, Love, The Omnivore's Dilemma, The Secret Life of Bees, The Kite Runner, and The Help. He also served 5 years as marketing director of Perigee and has been associate publisher of Riverhead Books and trade paperback marketing director for Portfolio and Sentinel. Before coming to Penguin Group, Patrick was sales director for Disney Hyperion and worked at Houghton Mifflin and Waterstones Booksellers. When I spoke with Patrick Nolan last week, I began by asking him what the book industry looked like before Alan Lane came up with his ideas in 1935.
Well, my understanding of it was that this was an industry that was quite conservative, quite traditional, where great literature was published in a very sort of elitist kind of way, high-priced hardcover publishing, sold in carriage trade bookstores. We didn't have chains. We didn't have book sections in groceries or you know, kiosks at train stations or bus stations or airports selling books. So it was something reserved for a very privileged, quite wealthy, highly educated group of people.
Okay.
And I think Alan Lane just saw that really good books can appeal to a wide range of readers, not everyone who just has money or has been to Oxford and Cambridge. And basically, he had this idea after being super frustrated coming back from a trip out to visit Agatha Christie in the country. He was at the train station, and all he could buy were these kind of not-so-good Victorian novels and magazines. And so he left his job at one of those kind of stodgy publishers and founded Penguin Books, and the idea was we're going to publish great literature in paperback that's affordable, that's sold not just in bookstores but where people are and where readers are.
Okay, that's interesting.
Quite revolutionary.
Yeah,
and in a way it really reflects kind of the way books are sold today.
Yeah.
And, you know, it the spirit of that, both digitally and physically, I think lives on with much of what the book industry is doing, not just at Penguin Books.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk a little bit about that in a little bit. I the first thing I wanted to ask you, though, after this is about the Penguin logo.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's just such an awesome logo, and it's so – everybody recognizes it. Yeah, and I was reading in the literature that it was suggested by Alan Lane's secretary, and it was just sort of – I don't know if it was just a toss-off idea, but it was such a – brilliant idea. So
I think it was one of those. I think it's funny. We're going to publish a book this fall. This beautiful picture book called The Journey of the Penguin, and it's this imaginative idea of Alan Lane hosting auditions with all these different wild animals in his office for who his logo was going to be, and the lucky penguin having the spotlight hit it just in a certain way so it falls into that oval, making the cut. But I think in reality it was just as you describe. It was an idea, and it was sort of such a good idea that there weren't massive consumer studies or polling or lots of conversation. I think they just went, okay, it's Penguin, let's go. and it's really lived more or less exactly the way they designed it, with some slight changes. I think a few years ago we made the Penguin a little slimmer, but essentially it's the original logo.
Now, this is kind of a funny question, but I was wondering if there's been any impact on Penguin Books through the recent years, when the Penguin itself has become sort of trendy, you know, like with the movies March of the Penguins and Happy Feet. Do you know if that's had any impact on people's interest in the books, or is that not...
Well, it's funny. I mean, we do a lot of social media here, and we do encounter a lot of people who are penguin lovers, the bird, who are also really curious and following us as well. So I think it helps, and I think it helps make the brand be really the singular brand in book publishing that people know and think of, and really do when they think about it. It goes back to kind of what Alan Lane was originally thinking about, that these are really high quality books that either will entertain or teach you something. And we do almost entirely only paperbacks at Penguin, so they're also affordable.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about some of the authors that you've worked with in your life as an editor.
Sure. And my life as an editor has been rather short, I should add, or start to say, because I started as a bookseller and worked my way up to this current position in a lot of different selling positions and marketing jobs. Uh-huh. And so I've been an editor for about 3.5 years. But along the way, I've been working with a lot of really talented, brilliant writers, many of whom are still at work on their novels or nonfiction pieces. For example, Alex Gilvary, who wrote Memoirs of a Non-Enemy Combatant and was named one of National Book Foundation's 535. He's working on his new novel for me that I'm really dying to read. I've read about half of it so far, and he'll deliver that to me at the end of the summer, and we'll publish it probably in early 2017. So it's sometimes a long process to the books. But I'm working with this brilliant architect named Matthias Holovich, and he has written what I see as a manifesto that could change the way all of us think about aging, because the first principle in the book, it's almost like food rules for aging.
Okay.
The first principle is, define yourself old early. So at age 40, just say you're old, get it over with, and then start thinking about the journey of your life in a way that will allow you to have a full, healthy, wholesome life all the way through, where you don't have to end up in a nursing home before you need to. He's thinking about our social space, our physical space. It's a really exciting book, and he's becoming a leader in this thinking around his architecture and also around sort of the societal fabric that has to change and reform. So I'm excited about that.
Yeah. What's his name again? I'm sorry.
His name is Matthias Holovich.
Okay. All right. Great.
And he's here in New York. He's a very active architect, and this is his first book. So I'm really excited about that.
Yeah.
When I think about associate publisher, we publish about 250 books a year, and we work with some of the absolute greatest writers around right now. Currently, Daniel James Brown, who wrote Boys in the Boat. He's our number one bestseller, and he's just an amazing guy. And this book has touched a nerve and has become a book that, you know, originally only rowers were reading, and now CEOs are reading it. Anyone who's an aspiring athlete, people who are just looking for an inspiring story that leads to team success is coming to this book in a way that, in a way we never could have imagined. It's now well over a million copies. Also, we have this brilliant young debut writer, Celeste Ang, who wrote Everything I Never Told You, and she is just a joy and a talent to watch. And if you haven't read this book, it's the book, I think, to read for the summer. If you're looking for that perfect novel to take on vacation, this would be the one to take.
Okay. So,
yeah, there's lots of great... I could go on and on.
Yeah, no, wonderful. And also historically, I was looking at the list that was sent to me by Penguin Publicity, and I just lost myself in this list. You know, some of my favorites include Ken Kesey, William Trevor, Wallace Stegner, more recently Geraldine Brooks, Amy Tan, David Foster Wallace. I was just like, oh my God, it just keeps going and going.
It's a really impressive list, and it's a real honor to work with them. And we do have about 5,000 books in print on the Penguin Books list, so that list is just the tip of the iceberg.
Absolutely.
And in our anniversary year this year, too, we're celebrating two centennials, Saul Bellow's this summer. We've done a beautiful new edition of Herzog, and we've put Ravelstein into Penguin Classics for the first time. Mm-hmm. And then in October, Arthur Miller's centenary is coming, and so we have a lot of big events to celebrate his plays and his life, both in New York and around the country. And we're also publishing for the first time a collection of the complete plays, all in one volume. Mm-hmm. So we're really excited about that. So,
wow, that's great.
That list just keeps going.
Yeah. So this is just an anecdote, but I have a brother and sister-in-law who own a little black classics box set of Penguin books that I have coveted forever. Like every time I visit them, I'm like, that is so cool. So I was excited to see that as part of the 80th anniversary, Penguin is issuing a new little black classics box set. So,
yeah.
Where will these be made available? Is there a special route, or is it just like buying a book? You go where you usually buy.
Yeah, I hope you'll be able to find it in the fall out in the stores wherever you buy books. It's a big box. It's 80. They're small books, but it's 80 books all in one box, and it's a great selection. Some very well known authors and some totally new discoveries for most people, I think, all drawing on our Penguin Classics list, which is about 1,300 titles right now, and growing every week.
Yeah, and by the 100th anniversary, they're going to have to put out like a new bookshelf to put the set on.
I know. That's the problem with these years as they keep growing.
Yeah.
I feel like when we had our 75th anniversary, we had these massive parties. We had a big party in the New York Public Library, and we had a car, this little mini with the Penguin logo that drove around the country and celebrated our anniversary. And with the 80th anniversary, it seems like we're sort of getting serious. We're new aging properly here, and we're just doing what we do, focusing on publishing, having a great time doing it, but really focused on these important authors and making sure that as many people can discover them as possible.
Yeah, that's great. Well, so as I prepared for our conversation, Patrick, I was reading a little bit about 1935, which is the year that Alan Lane started Penguin. And I was struck by certain similar undercurrents to today's world. You know, there was the global economic downturn, damage to the ecology and agriculture by way of the Dust Bowl, race riots in Harlem, international upheaval. Hitler reinstated the Luftwaffe in violation of the Treaty of Versailles. So much, much upheaval. And yet, people responded very positively to Alan Lane's model. 3 million books were sold the first year after Penguin went into business. So I'm just wondering if you could talk about this juxtaposition of upheaval and success and people's turning to books in times of difficulty.
Yeah, I mean it's an interesting moment, and in a way I think that it's a timeless thing, turning to books, turning to books for comfort, turning to books for escape, turning to books for enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the time that I've been here in publishing, I've seen that. You know, it was it was, you know, as a very extreme example, right after 9/11, we had a massive increase in demand for our Penguin Classics edition of the Koran. Mm-hmm. And in a way, that seemed like a really great sign of people trying to get past that horrific event and get greater understanding, mm-hmm. and understand the world better. And it's an important mission. I mean, we're trying to publish books that are just going to entertain and take people away. But we're also always thinking about how can we make the world better, and add to the conversation that is important to the key events of the day. I mean, as much as even with our Penguin Classics list, in the time that I've been here, we've made a great effort to make it a truly global list and to embrace all the great writers of the world and not sort of sit in that sort of Western European American literary space that we had been in for probably the first 70 years of our history. Mm-hmm. And so so it's something that even in the industry itself, that there's been a lot of turmoil in the industry in the last years with the sudden arrival and sudden exponential increasing of sales from the digital side of things. Many people were predicting that books were going to disappear, but they sort of missed the point that it doesn't matter if you're reading a digital book or a physical book, you're still reading books, and books matter, and what writers think about and write about matters. But it did cause a lot of speculation outside of our industry that things were going to change and the books were going to become less relevant. But just look at what's happening today with Harper Lee's new book. It's an important event. It's setting record sales, and people are talking about books and engaged in books. And I think in a way that never changes.
Right.
It's one of the great things about our culture.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Patrick, my radio show is for readers, but also writers. A lot of the people who listen to the show are writers looking for craft advice or publishing advice. So I wondered if you might, for our last question here, have any advice for writers, people who'd like to have books in the world but are maybe confused about the best way to go about it, given the way that publishing keeps redefining itself.
Well, that's an interesting way to put the question, because I think I would suggest right away that the first thing the writer needs to do is to find his or her voice, mm-hmm. and stay with it and not worry about kind of the whims of our publishing industry or what's selling or what people are talking about. In a way, it's being true to your own voice, believing in that voice, and perfecting it and honing it as carefully as you can. And then, I mean, the next step really is to find that right pairing of editor and agent. Right. And that is easier said than done. But I think once that happens, the potential for a long lasting developing career is there. Staying true to your voice, finding someone who believes in you and can champion you all through the publishing process, not just the editorial nitty-gritty that's going to happen on the page, but also just through the publication. The editor plays such a key role in championing a writer's work long after the books hit the bookshelves.
Right.
So that's such an important decision. It's hopefully it's like a marriage and it's going to last forever. There's always opportunities to make changes if it doesn't, but that relationship is so critical that it has to be done with extreme care and consideration, and agents bring a lot to that decision, because they spend their entire working life meeting editors, talking to publishers, understanding who has certain talents and tastes, and they find that they're really great matchmakers. And so I'd say going through an agent is also a great thing.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you for that advice. Thank you for speaking with me. Patrick Nolan, Vice President, Editor-in-Chief, and Associate Publisher of Penguin Books. I really appreciate your time today, and happy anniversary to Penguin.
Thanks. It's great to talk to you.
I hope you enjoyed those two interviews that we did today with Jacob Paul and Patrick Nolan. Jacob Paul's website, if you want to read more about him, is, I believe, jacobgpaul.com. But I'll link both websites, Penguin's website and Jacob Paul's website, to the podcast site so that you can find out more information. This week's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my first guest, Jacob Paul, who in 2014 collaborated with friends Sarah Martin, who's a photographer, and Adam Moser to create a project titled Home for an Hour. Adam Moser invited seven couples to each spend an hour by themselves in his apartment in Greensboro, North Carolina. The couples were encouraged to do whatever they wanted with no one else watching them. And meanwhile, outside on the snowy lawn in the very cold weather, like the opposite of his experience doing our first interview, Jacob Paul sat all bundled up on the lawn at a typewriter composing a fictional narrative about each couple. In one of the resulting stories, a participant meditates on the meaning of the word common. Another story presents an imagined conversation between two people as they sit in the apartment drinking a box of wine. None of the stories was revised before being collected into the Home for an Hour book. So the prompt for this week, generously offered by Jacob Paul, is to have a friend or friends go do something that you can't watch, and in real time, while they're doing it, write a fictional documentary account of what they might be doing. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. There's no time for the Bookworm's calendar this week, I'm afraid, but it will return soon. I do want to tell you that Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Calamity and Crows Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, Jerry Bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule, custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crows Trading Post on Facebook. And also by The Farmhouse, Burlington's farm-to-table gastropub serving award-winning burgers, innovative entrees, and a world-class craft beer menu. If you are interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know. They can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com. As free podcasts, you can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. And you can also access the podcast by going to my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com, or by visiting the website of my co-host, Gary Miller, at garyleemiller.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And finally, please remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. Everything you hear at The Radiator happens thanks to volunteers. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont.